Okay, you were saying?
Right. Well, this the MFA has really become the basic degree for persons who hope to teach with any kind of art school or college art department. It is, you might say, the doctoral degree in art teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, as far as the number of credits are concerned, it was a two-year degree, but in point of fact, most of the students are now expecting to put in at least a three-year stint.
Now, I presume that when this was first brought up to the faculty, that they were, for the most part, enthusiastic about it, in, at least in theory.
Well, our department took the initiative in asking for it. Now, we did have a committee that was composed of Ms. White, somebody from drama. I can't remember who
was
on it.
Grilly was on it.
Grilly.
And a fellow named Brogdon, perhaps?
Well, Wolf Brogdon. Wolf was really, he's an associate dean of the graduate school.
Right.
And he didn't meet with the committee regularly, but we reported to him.
Mm-hmm.
And then he then in turn passed it on to graduate school committee and the graduate school meeting.
Right.
But you see, what we were asked to do, and this kind of surprised some of our faculty, was not to produce an MFA for the art department, to produce a Master of Fine Arts that could be the basic tool for an MFA in any of the art forms.
That is in drama, music.
Right, music, drama, dance, and like. And because they anticipated that if we wanted it, there was some likelihood that it might indeed be followed up by some of the others, and I think it has been. So it had to be on a rather general level, so much devoted to classes having to do with the major thrust of the department in the arts, leaving it in some general such statement as that. And while we did have to spend a lot of time phrasing it, and particularly to meet the requirements of Miss White.
Over her requirements.
Well, it was very interesting about her, because many of us thought that she was on the committee in order that there might perhaps be an MFA in literature, in writing.
Mm-hmm.
But before
that wasn't the case.
Before we got through, she flatly stated, "Oh no, this was not the kind of a." This was not the kind of a thing that a department of English in a university would ever want to do, because English was a scholarly discipline, as seen by the university.
Mm-hmm.
Writing was something that the artist, the writer, the literary person did. You didn't teach it. And so she flatly insisted there would, as far as she was concerned, there would not be an MFA in English.
You were simply mistaken in your perceptions.
Well, we didn't push it. We had simply casually remarked that, well, we had been, and in fact, Brogdon had taken this point of view from the first, that it must be flexible enough to be useful should the occasion arise for other departments. It must not be too specifically stated in terms of our studio. But we had no real problem with it, other than that we had to work on it quite carefully.
Mm-hmm.
And it was accepted without any real questions on the part of anyone.
This is my late 40s?
Oh, no. No, I don't think that came about until mid-50s sometime.
Oh. Now, in this field, I remember coming across an article where you mentioned that there was rather a debate going on between whether or not universities would be taking people with PhDs or MFAs to do their college teaching. Now, did this problem arise in your discussion of the MFA, and or did it arise at some later point in terms of hiring and that kind of thing?
It was definitely part of the plan that this would be a necessity for us to go to if our students were to be eligible for college teaching jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And it has been correct this has been pretty well accepted nationally as an adequate degree for people who are going to teach the practice of the arts, of the visual and plastic mm-hmm. arts in American colleges. Now, that doesn't mean that it doesn't, for instance, apply in the least bit to art history.
Mm-hmm.
Only to the actual studio practice of the arts.
Right. Now, what about art education?
Art education is in an interesting point of departure. The art education people getting college jobs are almost without exception now required to have a doctorate in art education. But there's also a change of direction becoming evident just in this last year or two. In order to have these doctorates in art education, there was a tremendous turn toward scientifically oriented studies of educational processes in art.
Mm-hmm.
At least that was their hope. So that there would be these studies of child reactions over a period of months or years, and using half a dozen different control groups, reaction to doing a certain thing or to visualizing certain forms of art, and then getting this all down into a very, very complete set of statistics as to choices that had been made.
This is not something that was done here, though.
We've done very little of this, partly because until Mr. Naseth came, none of us had a doctorate
mm-hmm.
in art, in educational processes. The people we had in art education had master's degrees in art education.
And when did he come?
And most of us were largely oriented toward teaching in elementary and high school work and toward the practice of studio arts. We were not, my background in no way has had anything much to do with educational processes and studied in a more or less scientific basis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Naseth did get his doctorate at Penn State, and now Ron Nepperud has his doctorate from University of Oregon. Both of them have had work in the other area. Now, however, there is this move against the scientism,
mm-hmm.
the study of children, especially children's reaction to the art experience and to the art artifact, the art object, and a strong tendency somehow to direct studies again to the experience rather than the categorization of the experience and the joggling with the figures.
Mm-hmm.
What will come of this, I don't know.
Now, does your department grant the PhD?
Yes.
This time in art education. When did that begin?
Well, the first two degrees granted to art education people that I recall were done by Arvel Bahr.
Mm-hmm.
The first one was a woman who had been in summer sessions for 21 different summer sessions. She had begun sometime in the early 30s and she finished up in the late 40s. Then a man came along who went to Bahr, and he wanted to do a doctorate on the basis of two different kinds of experiences. Children who had actually seen and talked about and got into a direct experience, and children who had been informed of an experience only by means of pictures, and then
mm-hmm.
what kinds of images did they make in these two very separate things. And on that, I became one of the committee. And so as long as Mr. Bahr lived, when anybody came along wanted a doctorate in art education, I would find out, first of all, if they seemed to have the kind of ability to run through that kind of thing, and a real desire to do the work and to last the course.
Mm-hmm.
And if they did, I'd send them up to him. He acted as chairman. And I would usually direct the project. And that worked very well. You never knew Dr. Barr, I'm sure. He was, Barr and Foulkes were either the first or among the very first people with a doctorate in education to come to the university. And both in their own way, at their best, were delightful citizens. And so it was interesting working with him. Since he quit, retired, I did work with some 7 or 8 people on the doctorate and managed to get projects that were interesting to me and to them that did not involve this kind of statistical data.
Mm-hmm.
And NEPRU has kind of gone on from there. And I will say that the 7 or 8 people that we did give degrees to, up to about that were in which I served as major professor, have done very well in the field. They are all in very good positions. One of them is running the Carnegie School of Fine Arts in Pittsburgh. He probably has the best sounding position,
mm-hmm.
hardest work to say. And so they've done reasonably well.
Uh-huh. I guess just have one more thing about the art education department, and that's, I don't think we've talked about this before, the creation of the elementary education integrated art course. I think we discussed this at other times, but not today.
That, I don't remember just when that came along. It certainly came along with a great deal of impetus from Virgil Herrick,
mm-hmm.
who was brought in by John Guy Foulkes. Virgil had been teaching during his graduate work at the university. He'd taught at the Country Day School in Milwaukee, and then he'd gone down to the University of Chicago. From there he came here to be the major influence in the elementary program, because
mm-hmm.
we hadn't really had one.
Right.
And we had a huge committee on the whole elementary program, and Virgil was very much interested in having a much, much more interesting experience for these people in the arts. And so we worked out what turned out to be a pretty good one. We had Jonathan Kirvin, Jack Kirvin in drama, Louise Klepper in dance, Bob Petzold in music, and myself in art. And these people were to have a 2-credit course, which was ridiculous. And we ran the thing, I think, 2 or 3 years. And it was terribly expensive in total time hours for the faculty people.
Mm-hmm.
And it could have been a really superb course. It lacked certain things. First of all, we all four of us found, first of all, that our departments couldn't have cared less whether we taught it or whether we didn't. And in this university, your department determines whether a thing seems to be important or whether it isn't important.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as long as John Guy was dean, if the department said, well, this thing doesn't count for very much when it came to thinking about promotion and salaries, of course, John Guy could always overrule a department when it got to his desk, which he did, because he was very keen about the elementary ed thing, and he wanted it to work.
Mm-hmm.
So that was all right, but you had a feeling that eventually it was to be a dead end. Because what we did was to have a group of about 25 people apiece, making a total of 100.
Mm-hmm.
We would run 4 meetings a semester of the whole group. One would be an art meeting, a dance meeting, a drama meeting, a music meeting. And then we would run, the other weeks, we would run our own separated activity. The faculty, however, met once and for an hour once a week. And we would develop vocabulary or ideas which we would all proceed to work with the following week. Just as an example, we would come up with form. Well, what is form in drama? Kirvin would work with his group on that. In visual arts, see, in music, and in dance, what is form?
Right.
We would try then in our group, in our big group meeting, to run through the whole thing, either having some of the people actually do some simple dance steps or a quick drama thing, do some work with art materials or something of the sort. And it really was a very good thing. But what it would have needed to survive and to be important would be that ought to be about half of our load, guaranteed for about a 4-year period, with some time out for writing, for illustration, and for publication, none of which we ever got.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
See, that's one of the problems in trying to develop something new and really kind of stimulating in interrelated media.
Well, why would you say that the departments weren't interested?
Because they weren't. I'd go to the art department, I'd mention what we were doing. Oh, yeah, kind of interesting. What are you doing with those dames anyway? That would be the attitude.
Uh-huh.
What do you care?
But that wasn't that much different from your field of art education.
Yes, but you see, these were not art majors. And the tendency in a big university is you care about the person who is going to reflect you.
Mm-hmm.
See, you care about the talented, especially in the arts. You care about the talented person. Here were a bunch of freshmen. And not only that, they weren't freshmen in art, they were freshmen in elementary education. Why spend your time on those people?
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that we have that kind of pattern. I think it's you'd find it in the university today if you didn't tried anything like that again.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is why the ILS programs, which got started with such grand furor, finally fade out. It's an adventure in education, but it's not carrying your field to as high a pinnacle as you think you can do.
Right.
So that's why it finally doesn't work. You have to have a different attitude. Now, I think the greatest thing that was ever done in this university of that sort was Michael John's
Experimental College,
because you see there, they got him to do this one thing. They gave him the whole dormitory set up. And as long as that continued, it was a shining light.
Right.
But when the residence kind of nucleus faded out, Michael John left, became more or less routine.
Yeah.
Wasn't that good.
Right. Well, I think that about isn't that for our education, unless you can think of something else right now.
Well, there's all kinds of things in the documents and so on, of course, and if I do think of something,
Okay, if we can move now perhaps to a discussion of your experiences in this selection of the new deans of the School of Education, beginning with the search committee that eventually picked Dean Stiles to succeed John Guy Fawkes.
Now, that one was the one where Arvo Bauer was chairman.
Right.
Right. Well, in both of those, as I recall, first of all, we would have a meeting, and the chairman in both instances, Bauer in the first instance and Glenn I in the second, would ask the committee itself if immediately they had any strong candidates that came to their own minds, even as they got the letter of announcement. And in most cases, some of the people would have a person whom they felt ought at least to be written to or called up.
Mm.
And then the next step would be for the chairman to suggest what kind of person they felt we would be looking for. As I think back on it...
How are you chosen to this committee in the first place? That is, you know, and why was it that you needed to look for a dean in the first place?
I don't know how the committees were selected. It's a possibility that they were selected either by a kind of a steering committee for the School of Ed, or possibly the then chancellor or president may have simply selected a person to be chairman. I don't remember how we did that. It could have been in those years that the School of Ed had a meeting and entertained nominees for the chairmanship.
Mm-hmm.
And then proposed sundry names which the chairman could select. The School of Ed, at least in the first one, when Barr was chairman, was still relatively small in faculty numbers at the associate professor level and full professorship. And then another thing that they tried to do, of course, on both committees, and I think the membership shows that, was to represent fairly well the range of departments within the school then, so that there would have been that. But just what the mechanics of selecting the committee was, I can't remember.
Mm. And as far as why were you looking for a new dean?
Well, in the first instance, Foulkes had served seven or eight very busy years as dean, and worked very hard at it, and really was getting tired. You could tell he was getting weary about the whole thing. He worked very closely in this internship with Ford Foundation money. And Ford Foundation money came up with a project.
Of course, that was after he was dean.
Yes, right. John Guy, that is. And he worked very closely with him. Well, then the Ford Foundation had suggested some money, considerable money, to do some spade work in India to examine what the American contribution might be in improving education in India. And I don't know what the ins and outs of that were. I'm sure there are other people who are closer and better informed on that, but John Guy elected to be the person who would spend a year, a little more than a year, in India. And so he presumed to take a leave of absence as dean. And I never did talk to him about this, but in the newspapers, the story came out that Dean Foulkes was granted a leave of absence from the university. And, of course, Professor Foulkes could return at any time that his work in India was finished, if you catch the subtle distinction.
Uh-huh.
And he raised a little rumpus about that, but the regents were firm on the subject, and that's the way it was.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was just as well for John Guy, because he really had worked very, very hard as dean. He had put in untold hours every week. And he had gotten some shape to the thing. He started, you see, he really was doing a lot of work under C.J. Anderson before the war years were over, and then he worked very hard through all of the heaviest load of the G.I. period, and of getting sheer place for the School of Education to function, And it's just as well that he stopped being Dean. So that's why we had to look for a new one.
Mm-hmm.
And Barr is one of those men of whom it may be said that he was the consummate diplomat in the School of Education. Nobody would object to Arvo Barr as chairman of the committee, because he just was not a man who went about making enemies. It would be very difficult to be an enemy of his. And he was an excellent chairman, because he knew all of the ropes, who not to ruffle,
mm-hmm.
and how not to ruffle. And he had a very wide acquaintanceship in the country of people in education.
Mm-hmm.
And he had the committee was a good committee. It represented strong people in the School of Education.
Okay.
Well, at any rate, we did have the usual number of people, probably 20 or 30 people whose names were suggested, and most of the people who were widely associated in education knew many of these people, and we just crossed them out offhand, because they knew things about them that made it clear they weren't in the category that we wanted them to be. They were perhaps too young or very vigorous, but quite inexperienced in administrative activities. For various reasons, they just wouldn't do. They were people who were prominent in education, but had not been around enough to do the kind of job we felt they would have to do.
Were some of these names that we would recognize today?
I think you would. I've recognized two or three of them in the years since.
Who were some of these people?
Well, I can't remember them. I'm not close enough to these general education kinds of persons to know them unless they've come here and work here. But when I see some of these names, as in some of the U.S. Office of Education journals, I think to myself, oh yes, he was one of the candidates we had. They were obviously a group of people who have remained outstanding in education, so that we had good names. Two or three of them came up, and those are the people whose names I recognize when I see them, and I do see them occasionally, so that they have done good things since. They were at that time rather young. They had just made a big hit in one way or another on the smaller educational venture. But this school needs diplomats above all others, you know, because we have such rather widespread connections in the College of Letters and Science, and the variety of departments in the School of Ed itself, including very close contact with the arts, music, drama, and so on. It's not a compact, easily understood, easily organized School of Ed. It's got to be somebody who's considerably more than simply a good researcher in educational procedures.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so that's, of course, when we got Dean Stiles. And obviously, you see, he came from Virginia School of Education, been dean there. But he was more of a Middle Westerner and a Far Westerner himself. He welcomed the chance to come to the Midwest, where he stayed now. And I think he was a good person to follow Fowlkes. He didn't have the drive that Fowlkes had, but I think perhaps people were a little tired of Fowlkes' drive, too. Many people were, who had just gotten just this way, you know. He was the kind of person you had to stand up to, and if you weren't that kind, you could get terribly upset by some of his demands upon you in a personality way.
Were there any noticeable changes in the operation of the school as a result of the selection of Dean Stiles? Anything that you noticed?
Well, I was chairman for a couple more years, or it seems to me I was in there. Yes, I was.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he did during the first couple of years was to make a very real effort to iron out salary inequities. I think these had become quite apparent to an outsider. Perhaps they weren't as apparent to John Guy because he had known everybody in the school. You see, John Guy had been here since, I think, 1923.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, it was rather good to have somebody like Stiles come in who didn't have very many associations at all, except possibly the kind of thing that he knew some of the people from conventions or something like that. But I think he tended to take care of some of the more glaring salary inequities that had been developed in several of the departments and calm things down a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It was probably good in that respect. Now, I wasn't close enough to him to know what some of his major problems may have been, because on the whole, he did quite well with us.
Mm-hmm.
He was pleased to be dean of an art department. He'd never had that experience before, a really big art department.
Mm-hmm.
The University of Virginia doesn't have much of an art department, and it had no direct relationship to the school ed, so that was a new experience for him.
Mm-hmm.
And he did become acquainted with the department and spent some time finding out about it.
Mm-hmm. One thing one might naturally ask is that this Wisconsin Improvement Program and the Ford Foundation, so on and so forth, that began while Stiles was dean, apparently was brought about through the efforts of Faulks.
Oh, yes.
And now that seems like something that you expect your dean to arrange or to take care of. Is there a problem there?
I was not aware of it. Now, of course, by that time we had hired Jim Stoltenberg and created that agency. You know, Stoltenberg has general charge of all of the student teaching assignments,
right,
and that sort of thing. And so Stoltenberg had quite a little to do with the administration of the Ford Foundation monies that were directed toward the various programs of teacher training. And he was very good at it. I don't remember whether Faulks hired him. I think he did. And certainly Stiles strengthened that office and made it a very, very helpful office to all of us, because we really needed that. When you have some 20-odd departments all working through the schools, you really need somebody who will bring all these things to a focus and act as a kind of an intercessor at times,
mm-hmm,
between the schools and the individual departments. And I think that came about. I doubt if it has much outside money now, but it got started with some of that Ford money.
Okay, now in the early 60s then, you were again on a selection committee. This time the eventual winner was Dean McCarty.
Yes.
Now, he came from within the school itself, is that correct?
No.
No, not originally.
No, he didn't.
Okay, it was afterwards that he became a professor.
Yes, he retired as dean and became professor. He's at administration,
right,
isn't he? Yeah. No, he came to us from one of the New York State universities.
Mm-hmm.
Cornell, I think.
Now, again, why was Stiles leaving you, and why, how did you get to be on this committee again, and so on and so forth? Do you remember?
Let's see now. Start with the first question first. Um, I just don't remember why he left. Did he go from here to Hawaii first, University of Hawaii?
I don't know.
It seems to me that he may have done that. He had an offer to spend a semester there. But then after that, some very close friend of his offered him the position he now holds, which is one of the name professorships at Northwestern.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a very plushy thing, a high salary, practically make your own program, work with a very small seminar group of graduate students and the like. And Stiles, even when he came, had made the point, as I recall, that the deanship of a department of this size, he felt, shouldn't last any one person more than 5 to 7 years or so. And there's some reason to think that that's probably not such a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
So that he had no intention of trying to be an indefinitely tenured dean. And I can't remember, just he did have some associations with Hawaii, but whether that was before he came here or afterward, I'm not altogether clear.
Mm-hmm.
And he just stopped being chairman. I think he had every intention of staying here. Did he stay here a while longer after he left the deanship?
I'm not sure.
I'm a little mixed up in there because I was had some rather serious operation just before I went to Nigeria, and I lost track of some things. So I'm not sure. But at any rate, when he left, we did have this other committee, and Glenn I was chairman there, and he was just as skilled, somewhat differently, from Barr, a little more direct, a little speedier. Mr. Barr was an old-fashioned gentleman and rather slow-moving in these matters. Glenn and I was a little more, let's get this show on the road and look into things. But again, as I remember the committee, it was a very good one. And we got these people down to the point where we had 3 or 4 of them, and we did have them come here and visit. And it was very interesting how closely those people lived up to their advance billing.
Oh, yeah.
People would say, well, this man could be one of the good ones, but he will be thus and thus and thus. And I'm not sure how you'll react. If he's got a weak spot, this will be it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was rather curious how every single one of those predictions came out very firmly.
Now, when these people came, did they come and just simply talk to your committee, or were they escorted around the campus?
Well, McCarty is a good case in point. He's the one with whom I had most to do. He came, and we scheduled, each of us on the committee, scheduled a meeting with the candidate. And we'd had one or two other people who'd come and who had just been a bust. Not, they weren't strong people, but it was quite clear they were not what we were looking for, and we didn't go too far with it. McCarty we had great hopes for, and so we scheduled meetings, small meetings, every member of the committee to act as a kind of a host. So we had a meeting with McCarty. Well, now here's McCarty, you know what he's like. And he's been a military man, and still in the National Guard, I think. I'm not sure about that. He was. But still a very affable gent, and I knew that my art group would be a little miffed about military types. Art people, by and large, are not great on the military, and many of our faculty were in the Second World War, so we had a little discussion one way and another, and I thought, well, we must get at this immediately. So I brought up his military training and his subsequent continuation of that, so that I forget at that time he was a major or something in National Guard. And I said, we are the art kind of group. They're not terribly keen on the military life or the military point of view. And we worry some, I know, about a dean who has been into the military activities as much as you have. And since that is going to be a major question with many of our colleagues, we'd like for you to talk to him. Which he did.
Mm-hmm.
Very well. And I can't even remember how he did it or what he said, but it was excellently done and convincing to people that heard him.
Mm-hmm.
I would think it would be something to the effect that he was interested in it. He felt strongly that a good National Guard was valuable on many campuses, that it had a function to perform, that some other activities didn't, for some men, not for all men. He certainly wasn't one, even the last thing in the world he would ever propose would be a required National Guard stint, and so on and so on. He did very well with it. And then I said, well, all right, I'll, not very many deans of schools of education suddenly inherit a full-fledged art department with a lot of rather interesting things going on that most deans of education know nothing about. Is that going to bother you? Is it something that you rather dread? And I don't know, again, do you know him very well?
No, I don't.
Well, he made some such comment as this. Well, he said, I've never been opposed to learning, and I said, I suspect I'll learn a great deal more out of the experience than you will from me.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that. He did excellently,
mm-hmm.
And that group of art department people were, nobody wanted to register any loud outcries or opposition to his candidacy.
Mm-hmm. I gather that they... what they heard about him or knew of him, they heard through you rather than directly from him, for the most part.
Prior to that time, yes. Well, they knew as much as I knew.
Mm-hmm.
We just had this little hoop sheet printed, and as far as I know, part of the time that he was dean, I was in Nigeria, but I, as far as I know, the department got along very well with him. Of course, he did have some of the trying years of the 60s to be dean, and any administrator had some very difficult decisions to make that the faculty didn't always like,
because mm-hmm.
it was not an easy time to be high up in the hierarchy in those years.
Can you give an example, I mean, of a decision he made that wasn't very popular, say in your department?
No, I don't have anything specific in mind at all. I don't think there was any major thing that he had to do. I'm simply aware of the fact that there were many times when the administration simply had to say to the faculty, this is the way it is, people, and we can't do anything about it. We're going to have to take this thing in hand and live with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was the way the middle and late 60s were. And you couldn't blame it on the chancellor or the deans or anyone else. It was obvious right in front of you. We had some very wild and less than happy times,
mm-hmm.
arguing with students about whether they should or shouldn't have grades and so on. Where were you during those years?
I was an undergraduate here starting in 1969.